Am I on, Robbie? Yeah. Oh, yeah. You'd have to put it on. Okay. Since it is a sermon, I have to give it a title. And I'm very bad at titles. But anyway, the best I could come up with, the last thing here, is a most choice human possession. That will be my title. Now, I'm not going to take time at this point to read my text. I'm going to get us into the text and be turning to 2:8-13. That will be my first text to get us into the book. And my second text to get us out of the book will be chapter 8 and verses 6 and 7. Those are the two texts that I will be working out of. Okay, but as I say, the Song of Solomon deals with our perhaps most choice, at least a most choice human possession, namely our love between a husband and his wife, and our love between Christ and his bride, the church. If I were to choose one text, I would use Psalm 7:7 to summarize the book. If one were to give all the wealth of his house to love, it would be utterly scorned. All of our portfolios, our houses, our possessions, everything we value, compared to love, is to be utterly scorned and rejected. You can't surpass this supreme possession. Yes. I think it's 7:7. 8:7. Well, there's an idea. Let's get that straight. Thank you, Gardner. 8:7. I don't know where the sermon's going at this point. I don't want to read 7:7. All right. The point is, this book, if we get back and get serious again, this book aims to inspire us to experience these loves and to teach us how to realize them. I wish I had read this book or understood before I married. If I'd understood its teachings, I could have avoided some of the pitfalls of marriage. And I think sometimes we hurt in our marriages because we have ignored this book. I think it's an important book to be taught in the church, and I hope I'm useful to you. Now, before we jump into the book itself, there are two interpretive issues that must be resolved. I've already anticipated one. The first issue that must be resolved is whether it's an allegory of a spiritual relationship, or is it to be read literally as a description of the sexual intimacy and love between a man and a woman. Until the Reformation, both the cynic, the synagogue, and the church read it as an allegory. The founders of rabbinic Judaism, such as we find in the Talmud, they read it as an allegory and insisted it be read as an allegory. They read it as an allegory between God and the people of Israel. The church fathers read it as an allegory of the relationship between Christ and his church. In the Council of Constantinople in 550, the church fathers forbade teaching the book literally as describing a sexual relationship that was not allowed in the church. And yet, the book's heavy emphasis on erotica, its detailed descriptions of the human body, forced me to understand that Solomon intended to be inspiring us and instructing us about human sexuality. I cannot see how all that detail was intended simply as allegory. On the other hand, when I see what Paul does with the Old Testament, I cannot limit the interpretation to just the human level. Consider how he handles the gift of the bride story in Genesis chapter 2, 18 through 25, at the conclusion of which saw a man and a woman become one flesh, united as one. Surely on a historical level, it's referring to the human relationship of marriage. But Paul doesn't limit it there. He sees something more. He sees a profound mystery. For this reason, he says, Genesis 2, this is Ephesians 5:31, quoting Genesis 2:24, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And then he adds, this is a profound mystery. That is, this is a hidden meaning until Paul. What I'm talking about is Christ and the church. And the union of the man and the woman is a profound hidden truth about the union of Christ and his church. Now, Paul does that with the gift of the bride story. I'm almost certain he intends for us to read the Song of Solomon, which is celebrating the relationship of a man and woman as some having some deeper, more profound meaning as to our relationship with Jesus Christ. Therefore, I reject the allegorical method because it denies the historical. I also reject the simple literalistic reading, historical reading, because I don't think it does justice to what Paul wants us to do with the Old Testament. And I think the conclusion is I end up with a typological approach, that it is literal, but that is a picture of something more profound of the relationship between Christ and his church. Therefore, I will drive no sharp wedge between the human and the spiritual dimensions of the story. The second interpretive question that has to be addressed in understanding the book and to exposit it is to decide whether or not there are two characters or three characters. According to the two-character theory, this is a chain of love songs between Solomon and the Shulamite, giving expression to all the aspects of the marriage love with one another, depicting love in all of its spontaneity, beauty, power, and exclusiveness, experiencing its varied moments of separation and intimacy, anguish and ecstasy, tension and contentment. But it's just Solomon and the Shulamite. And it's just a series of linked love songs. According to the three-character theory, it's drama. There is on one hand the rustic shepherd and the Shulamite, the maiden. He represents pure, simple love in its ideal, what we aspire for and from whom we can learn. The other character against the rustic shepherd is Solomon. And Solomon is the foil. He represents the blandishments of the royal court, power, riches, the opposite of the rustic shepherd, but not true love. I'm inclined toward the three-character theory. And the reason for it is, wherever Solomon is mentioned by name, it's negative. In chapter 1, he's associated with blackness, the color blackness, which is associated with her skin, which was because she was out in the hot sun, exploited by her brothers, and that's where Solomon comes in. In chapter 3 and verse 6, Solomon is not in the fields with the gazelles and the doles, the fertility and the spices and the orchard and the blossoming trees. Solomon is emerging out of a desert. That's the scenic depiction. And he's portrayed not with simplicity, but the chariot in which he is riding is of all the materials of the temple. He doesn't come with freedom and openness. He comes armed with 60 mighty men around him. He represents power, wealth, quite the opposite of the shepherd. Not true love, exploiting love. In chapter 8, at the end, in verses, I think it is 11 and 12, she tells Solomon, keep all your money, and she rejects him. So because of these three references to Solomon in a very negative way, I conclude that there are three characters. True love, the shepherd with true love, Solomon with false love, and then the Shulamite who has to choose between these two kinds of love. What I really think is that the rustic shepherd represents Solomon's ideals. I do not think this book is about Solomon in any case, the way someone would translate 1:1. Eon Proven does a very good job of the three character theory, but he's troubled with the problem of that it's by Solomon. I think it is by Solomon, and Solomon is representing the love he wishes he really had. I suspect that the rustic shepherd is the love he once knew, and he lost, and he dreams about, because he went after a different kind of love in his later years. Well, now I'm ready to get into the book that invites us into intimacy. The first text is Song, I hope I got this one right now, Song chapter 2 at verse 8. And it begins with the bride speaking. Here's the scenic depiction. Listen, my lover, look. Here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. It's hard for me to identify with that, leaping across the hills or a young stag. But as we'll see, the point of that, the reason they appeal to the stags and the does and the gazelles is they're absolutely free. And that's a very important quality of this. It speaks of freedom. And if I understand I have absolute freedom, I'm like a gazelle bounding across the field, because I'm not bound, I'm not constrained, I'm not restricted. Then he goes on in the scenic depiction. Look, there he stands behind our wall. In other words, there's a barrier between her and Solomon. There he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. And now she quotes her lover, and he invites her to intimacy. My lover spoke to me and said, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. In other words, it's an invitation to come out from behind that wall, that barrier that's separating you from me. Let's come out and let's enjoy one another. Now he speaks. She quotes him. Now this is his scenic depiction. See? The winter is past. The rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. The cooing of doves is in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit. The blossoming of vines spread their fragrance. In other words, what he's saying, it's a time for hope. It's a time for renewal. It's a time for refreshment of love. And I don't know where you are in your love life right now, but it might be a time of the coldness of winter. And maybe there have been the rain of tears in a relationship. Hopefully, this sermon will enable you to turn that around into springtime, into a time for renewal and for hope. And again, he begins with an invitation into intimacy and in what we know to be an inclusio. He ends again with that invitation, inviting her. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. Now at this point, the term we've been using, intimacy, cries out the definition. What does this book mean by human love and intimacy? What's involved in it? And when I first prepared the sermon, I had listed 12 points that characterize the intimacy of this book, that inspire us toward it and teach us what a marriage relationship should be. I boiled it down to just 4 for the lack of time. And to further help me, I've alliterated them, which I normally don't do. But the first point is, they are devoted to one another. I use the D there in place of marriage. In other words, the intimacy is experienced within a marriage relationship. By marriage, I mean their relationship is exclusive. There is no other. And it is public. She says, I am my beloved's, and my beloved's mine. And it runs throughout the whole book. It is their devotion to one another, to the exclusion of everyone else, is assumed in this book. It comes to its articulate expression after he has wooed her and courted her in chapter 4, where he likens her to a locked-up garden. He says to her, you are a garden locked up. This is 4:12 through 15. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard. Nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. And now she invites him into her garden. Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden, and that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into this garden and taste its fruit. Obviously, it is exclusive. But why bring the friends in at this point? It's also, paradoxically, both private and public. Their friends know of their commitment to one another. It's not some kind of affair going on in a secret corner. Everybody knows of this relationship. And so the friends join in. Eat, friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. Their commitment to one another is celebrated by their friends. This is marriage, both exclusive and public. But to help me to remember it, it is devoted. The second point I want to make, she has to make a decision for this relationship. She has to seek it for herself. One of the strange blanks in this book, really, it's a blank, is why hadn't her marriage been arranged for? In the ancient East, it was the responsibility of the father to arrange for their marriage. And if the father is not there, then it was the responsibility of the brothers to arrange for the marriage. But there has been, the father is not mentioned. The mother is, but not the father. I presume the father is not on the scene. But therefore, it is the responsibility of the brothers to have arranged her marriage. But her brothers, we learn, both at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book, instead of for arranging for her marriage, they have exploited her. They wanted her to work in the fields and make money for the family and have denied her her opportunities. That's how she begins with her self-description. She says, dark am I, yet lovely, daughters of Jerusalem. Dark like the tents of Kedar. Dark like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards, literal vineyards. My own vineyard, that is my own body, my own person, I have neglected. Now she seeks love. Tell me, you whom I love, where you gaze your flock, and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be veiled like a veiled woman? In other words, in order to rendezvous with her lover, she has to take on the guise of a prostitute beside the flock of your friends. She's put in a very difficult position where she has to reject her brothers who have exploited and bounded her and seek her love and her own identity, her own identification. She must also resist the powerful Solomon. She has to assert her own independence and her own choice, and she does this at the end of the book in Psalm 8, 11, and 12. Solomon had a vineyard, by which he means his harem. In Baal Hamon, which in Hebrew means a husband of a multitude. Solomon had a harem. He was a husband of a multitude. He didn't know what true love really was. Each was to bring for its fruit, that is, each of its queens and concubines, 1,000 shekels of silver. So valuable was each one of them by the world's standards. But my own vineyard, that is the body, is mine to give. The 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. That is, keep your money, Solomon, but pay those who tend to your harem, is what she intends here. So she has to reject her brothers. She has to assert her own identity and seek out on her own true love. That's a decision she has to make. The third point I want to make is, with the D, they treat each other with dignity in many different ways. They regard each other as unique. There is none like the other. They each one thinks of the other as unique. Notice this correspondence in 2, 2, and 3, where they express their uniqueness. He expresses her uniqueness. He says of her, "You're like a lily among thorns, is my darling, among the maidens." And she responds with him, "He's like an apple tree among the trees of the forest, is my lover, among young men." He says of Solomon, 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, but my God, my perfect one, is unique, the only daughter of her mother." 6, 8, and 9. They treat each other as the woman, not a woman. The man, not a man. They treat each other with dignity by recognizing one another as persons, not as bodies. When he begins his description of her body in chapter 4, verses 1 through 7, notice he begins with her eyes. "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a goat of flocks. It's like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead," says Proben. It is perhaps significant that the lover should begin with his beloved's eyes, even though he cannot see them clearly. For to look into the eyes is to encounter a person, not simply a body. They woo one another. They shall treat each other with dignity because they're wooing each other with praise and celebrating each other. Nothing caustic or hard. There is no compelling, no coercion. He woos her into the security of his person. 4:8-11, after praising her and wooing her, comes the invitation. "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from Tapasunir, from the summit of Hermon. Leave your lofty heights and come down to where I am. Furthermore, leave from the lion's den and the mountain horns of the leopards. Come to me in the valley where it is safe and you're secure." She will also say, "His banner over me is love." I don't want to push this too hard, but the word banner there, dego, is used exclusively in Numbers many times for war banners. She's secure and protected in his embrace as he moves her. They show each other dignity not only by treating each other as persons and as treating each other as unique and by wooing one another, but allowing each other to be free and spontaneous. Hear her in chapter 2 and verse 7. "Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does," those are those three animals of the field, "do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." And having given him that freedom, we thereupon begin our text. Look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. "My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag, totally free as he seeks out this relationship between us." Finally, fourthly, what this book means by intimacy is not only devotion, and not only a decision, and not only dignity, but it's being dialogical. There is no one text. That is the whole book. The whole book, as they engage in sexual intimacy, they are constantly talking to one another. And in that, they transfer physical intimacy from an animalistic, brutish relationship into a human, spiritual relationship, as they talk to one another. It's this that makes it beautiful. It is this that makes it spiritual and lovely. By their speech, they transform the physical act into a spiritual relationship. They humanize what the world has reduced to animal behavior. Note how sensitively, not crassly, they describe their relationship. They use subtle delicacy with which they evoke sensuous awareness while avoiding crude titillation. They accomplish this by indirection, by analogy, and by bringing to the foreground the sensuous in the world of nature, or in food, drink, cosmetics, and jewelry. Contrast the dialogues of this book with the speech of Lot's daughters who grew up in Sodom. Let's behave like all flesh. Got their father drunk, lay down with him, got up, and he didn't even know when they lay down or when they got up. Purely a brutish, animalistic act. This is dialogue. This is spirit. This is humanity. What's not in the book that I need to add because of the reality of who I am, intimacy involves forgiveness. The problem that I have with this book, because it sets forth love as ideal, while at one point she courts too slowly, they never really wrong each other. There's no need for forgiveness. But in my relationship, I know I wrong my wife, and I need forgiveness. And when I say intimacy involves forgiving one another, I mean by that when one hurts, the other asks for forgiveness, knowing the wrong will not only forgive, but feel the pain of the one who is ashamed. And I need to add that to the book. But now I turn to the second text. The second text is, this has been all wonderful about this relationship, but what we really want is an eternal, an abiding love, a love that will never perish, that will never pass away, regardless of the circumstances through which we pass. And now turn to 8:6-7. Love burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. What we are all looking for is a love that is constant, not fickle. A love that is reliable, not conditional. A love that is true, not hypocritical. And a love that is discerning. Paradoxically, marriage is both a consummation and an inauguration. Marriage isn't the arrival at life's destination. It's the beginning of an adventurous, lifelong journey. It isn't a flower-strewn pathway out of all of our problems. What is needed is a love that matures in joys and trials of marriage. What kind of love is that that can never be quenched? Here I find C.S. Lewis, in his Four Loves, extremely helpful. He analyzes all the different kinds of human loves and discovers only one is eternal. One he examines is need love. This is love that is preceded by desire. For example, if you're thirsty, you're dying of thirst, you would say, I would love a glass of water. And when you're drinking that glass of water, it is wonderful. But after you're drunk, you don't appreciate it anymore. Now, that's valuable. I'm not despising anything. Marriage, as Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, is an anodyne. It can anodyne. It can satisfy our sex drive, but that will not endure once it's satisfied. There's another kind of love. That's appreciative love. This is love that is not preceded by desire. It's because something is so desirable, in itself, you really want it. Unlike the glass of water, take a sweet pea flower. Flower. You don't need a sweet pea. But once you smell it, you keep coming back to it again and again and again just because it's lovely. Now, I think, not to diminish this book, that's what this book is. It's sweet pea love. They're each so beautiful, they keep being attracted back to that, to savor it, to enjoy themselves once again. But as good as that is, it will not endure. Physical beauty does not endure. Some of us, like me, never had it to begin with, for example. So it's hard for us to identify with this kind of a book. One time Elaine said to me, "Bruce, you have a profile like a god, Buddha." But the truth is, even if you have it, you lose it. It says, charm is deceitful and beauty is fleeting. The reason charm is deceitful is that beauty promises you a lifetime of happiness, but it doesn't last. And a marriage that's simply based on beauty is not going to last. Not only is physical beauty disappearing, also our spiritual beauty is tarnished. All of us are mixtures of good and bad. All of us on occasion smell like stale air, taste like bitter herbs, sound like jackhammers and vacuum cleaners. We get on each other's nerves. Where's love then? We need something that's more than that. A third kind of love is affection love. This is just simply by being together. You put people together for any period of time, they normally will develop some affection between them. I discovered this when I used to take tours to Israel. When I was still in Dallas, I used to take up to 80 people on tours to Israel. And I was amazed after 3 weeks how the people would bond. There was genuine affection. And almost invariably they'd say, "Bruce, let's have a reunion when you get back to Dallas." And so we would have a reunion in the fall. They'd fly in from New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, all over the country they would fly, just to see one another again. But we never had a third reunion. Out of sight, out of mind. It doesn't endure. A fourth kind of love is friendship love. This is a love based on a shared point of view, a common appreciation. And this is good and necessary in a marriage. The trouble is we change. I started out as an Arminian. Now I'm a Calvinist. I started out as a pre-mill. Now I am an R-mill. Trouble with me is when I change, I have to move. I can't do it privately. It means I can take the whole family with me. But the point I'm making is that we change. And one day you wake up and you discover the only thing you have in common is you were married on the same day. Conclusion is that all these loves are to be celebrated, but they all fail because they are all tinged with selfishness. There's only one love that transcends it all, that he's really asking for, and that is a divine love. That's totally unselfish. All our loves, never quite simply, seek the good of the loved object for the object's own sake. But the divine gift of love is wholly disinterested in self, serving, self-serving, and desires what is simply best for the beloved. I love the vision of the Lady Julia. She saw God and he had no need of it, he had need of nothing, but out of love and his own desire, he brought into being a hazelnut. And he held it in his hand. He loved it just for itself, had no need for it. He held it and wouldn't let it go. That vision meant a lot to one of my colleagues at the region. And when he was dying of cancer, another very sensitive professor gave him on his dying deathbed a hazelnut to remind him God would never let him go. The morning after he died, they found the broken shells of that hazelnut under his pillow, because he knew the God who made him through his parents' hands would never let him go. Now, I think that vision is beautiful. But to me, it doesn't compare with what I read in the New Testament. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He gave us an orchard of delight. We ate its fruits. We spat in his face. And still he died for us. That's love. That love cannot be quenched. Well, the question then arises, how do we experience this divine love? And that leads me to the mystery of the book. You experience this divine love in exactly the same way you experience the love in marriage. by the same four means. First of all, it must be exclusive and public. You must be devoted to our Lord. Of Him you're able to sing, I am my beloved, and He is mine. He is like the pearl of great price. To have Him, you sell everything else you have in order to have Him. He's unique. There's no one like this. He's the only one. And we publicly declare it. For if we were ashamed of Him, He would be ashamed of us. But we celebrate publicly this relationship. We identify with His church through baptism. It's a marriage relationship, exclusive and public. And secondly, you have to make a decision. You have to seek this love. You have to separate yourself from your old boundaries, like Abraham left his homeland, his relatives, his country, and he set out for a pilgrimage with God. And in the same way, we have to resolutely reject our peers, our families, as the disciple who wanted to follow Jesus said, let me first go back and bury my father. He said, no, let the dead bury their own dead. You have to identify within a new boundary and establish this relationship. Thirdly, we treat each other with dignity. We accept God's freedom to elect. We don't dictate to God. He has freedom here. And He gives us freedom. Obviously, in Reformed Seminary, we are convinced and we celebrate the doctrine of sovereign grace. But it's God who works in us both to will and to do His good pleasure. And the way He wins us is by wooing us, by giving us a sense of our freedom. And He says to me, come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And He guarantees all that come to Him. No one will ever pluck you out of my Father's hands. You are secure here. And finally, it is dialogical. That is our relationship. That's what I was saying. I'm really appreciating the Lectio Divina. My relationship to God, first thing in the morning, is I just follow the steps of the Lectio Divina. I read His love letter to me, His promises to me. And I respond by meditating upon it, internalizing it, and then I respond with not only the reading and the meditatio, but with the oratio. I respond with prayer back to God. I adore Him. I confess. I'm renewed. I'm with intercession and petition and thanksgiving, and then contemplatio. I silently wait before God until it enters into my very being. It is dialogical. Hence we embrace the best. This is love divine, all loves excelling, joy of heaven to earth come down. Fix in us thy humble dwelling, all thy faithful mercies crowned. Jesus, thou art all compassion, pure unbounded love thou art. Visit us with thy salvation, and to every trembling heart. It isn't quite like a lecture to end with a series of poems, but it's wonderful. All right, that's the Song of Solomon. Maybe it'd be fitting to end in prayer. Father, our hearts filled with praise for your choice gift. We squandered it like prodigals. But you forgive. Your mercies are new every day. Thank you that each day is a new opportunity